mine to answer in full.
It is not the only riddle on these shores.
There was a sorrow in his voice, 800 years old. The sun stood overhead, casting the master of the straits' face into shadow as he bowed his head.
Who takes my shackles inherits my power. Name its source if you would be worthy to serve.
Jocelyn turned aside with a sharp cry. I think until then he thought there was still a way he might answer. I raised my face to the sun, thinking, remembering. The library in the tower, the lost verses. Delaunay's library, where I had spent so many sullen hours, forced to study when I'd rather have entertained patrons. I'd have given anything to have them back now. Alcuin, hair falling like foam, to curtain his face, poring over ancient codices. Jocelyn's voice, unwontedly light, a rare glimpse of the Siovalli's scholar-lord son he'd been born. He's got everything in here but the lost book of Raziel. Can Delaunay actually read Yeshuite script? The pieces of the puzzle came together. I lowered my gaze, blinking. It is the book of Raziel, my lord. The master of the straits began to turn my way. Only pages. Hyacinth's voice was like a hollow reed sounding. Pages from the lost book of Raziel. That the one god gave to Edom, the first man, to give him mastery over earth and sea and sky, and took away, for his disobedience, casting it into the depths. The master of the straits stopped and considered him. Hyacinth gave his desperate laugh, black eyes blurred with the Dromond, seeing at last. A gift of your father, yes? The admiral calls him the Lord of the Deep, and tosses him gold coins, for he is superstitious, as sailors are. But the Yeshuites name him Prince of the Sea, the angel Rahab, they call him. Pride and insolence, who fell and was cleaved and made whole, who fell but never followed. The words came faster, tumbling from his lips, his blank gaze seeing down the tunnel of 8 centuries. I remembered a blazing fire, the sound of fiddles skirling, Hyacinth playing the timbals, while an ancient woman cackled in my ear.
Don't you know the Dromond can look backward as well as forward?
He begot you, my lord, upon a Dangeline girl who loved another, who loved an Alban, son of the Culloch Godam, a mortal, one of Earth's eldest. Is it not so?
It is so, the master of the straits murmured.
Hyacinth ran his hands over his face. The straits were still open then, free waters. He took her here, to this place, this isle, the third sister, still untouched by the science of Eloah, and she bore you here. Though she loved you, she sang in her sorrow and captivity, like a bird in a cage, until her song carried across the waters, and the Alban who loved her sailed the straits to free her. He fell silent.
They died.
The words rose around us, filled with the sea's deep surge, ceaseless and sorrowing.
The waves rose, their boat overturned, and the deep water took them. I know where their bones lie.
The master of the straits gazed across the sea from his vast open temple, the fluid shifting of his features fixed in grief.
And the one god punished Rahab's disobedience and bound him to his will, Hyacinth whispered. But for the heart of a woman he could not sway, and his own lost freedom, Rahab took his vengeance, and laid Aegeus upon you, my lord. He brought up scattered pages from the deep to give you mastery over the seas, and he bound you here, that Olba and Terdange would ever be separated by the waters you ruled, until love, daring enough to cross the breach, was born once more, and one came willing to take your place. The master of the strait spoke with the finality of a wave crashing to shore, and I knew then that I had lost. It is so.
Hyacinth straightened, his face cleared, and he laughed, a raw gaiety to it this time.
Well then, my lord, will I serve? You will serve.
The master of the Straits inclined his head, his eyes gone a dark and compassionate blue.
A long and lonely apprenticeship, until you are ready to take on the chains of my gears, freeing me to leave this earth and follow Eloa's path, where heaven's bastard sons are welcome.
You have used us harshly, elder brother,
Quintilius Rouse muttered darkly.
What's to become of the lad, then?
I have used you less harshly than fate has used me.
The master of the Straits turned an implacable face to him.
The sea has loved you, friend sailor. Count it a blessing. Half your folk would have died in the crossing had I not taken you in hand. My successor will be bound to this isle, as was I. That curse will not be broken until the one god repents of my father's punishment, and his memory is long.
What of the Straits? Drustin asked in Cruinia. His brow was furrowed with the effort of following the proceedings, for Hyacinth's words had been in Dangeline. Enough, though, he understood.
Will the crossing remain forbidden?
You hold that key.
The pale hand pointed once more at the gold signet on Drustin's finger.
Wed and open the lock. Not but 20,000 howling Scaldi and the traitors of Cumlach stand in the way,
Quintilius Rouse said sardonically,
while we languish on a forsaken rock in the middle of the sea with no army in sight.
I promised my aid,
the master of the Straits said, unmoved,
and you shall have it.
He swept his arm above the bronze vessel again, its waters rippling.
All that has passed in Terdange I will show you. Your men and your horses and arms I will bring safe to land. No more can I do. Will you see it now?
They looked at me. Surprised, I looked back and found I was trembling. Truly there is a limit to what the mind can compass in one day. I'd risen prepared to chain my life to this lonely isle. It is a hard thing to turn aside from so deep a path. No, I said, shaking my head and struggling to keep my voice steady. My lord, if it please you, I would ask a little time, an hour mayhap. Might we have that long?
You may. I will send for you an hour before sundown.
He bowed, then turned to Hyacinth.
This day I give you. Only know that your feet will never again leave this soil.
Hyacinth nodded, sober-eyed.
He understood.
In the tower once more, in a sitting room with glassless windows, I called for wine, raising my voice sharply. The servants jumped and hurried to obey. I was beyond caring at that moment. I drank half a glass at the draught when it arrived, and looked hard at Hyacinth. The others drew away, leaving us alone. Why? I asked him. Why did you do it? He smiled faintly, toying with the wine glass in his hands. There were dark smudges under his eyes, but now that the worst had come to pass, he seemed more himself.
I couldn't have, without you, you know. I didn't have the answer. It was so vast I couldn't see it.
He drank a little wine and stared past me out the window. I knew it when I saw the isle, that my road ended here. I just couldn't see why. Last night, when I saw what you knew, I was afraid.
Hyacinth. My voice broke as I whispered his name, tears starting in my eyes. A nation at war has no need of Anguissettes. It should be me. Let me stay.
And do what? He asked gently. Throw rocks at the Scaldi, knife the dying, tell their fortunes. A nation at war has no need of Tsingani half-breeds untrained to arms, either.
You have the Dromond. It is more than I can offer.
It is the Dromond that brought me here, Phaedra.
Hyacinth took my hands in his and looked down at our interlaced fingers. It's the Dromond that sets me apart from Dangeline and Tsingani alike. If it has led me to a place where I belong, then let me stay. Releasing my hands, he touched the diamond at my throat.
"Kushiel marked you as his own," he said softly.
Whatever target he had in mind when he cast his dart, I think it was not the Master of the Straits. I shuddered and looked away. Besides, Hyacinth added wryly, that damned castling would only turn around the instant we reached dry land, swim the straits, and damn the lot of us. Bad enough he's vow-blinded. Being besotted with you makes him a positive menace.
Jocelyn?
Startled, I raised my voice. Jocelyn looked over, brows raised in inquiry. I shook my head at him, and he turned back to Rouse.
Eloa help him if he ever comes to realize it.
Hyacinth traced the line of my brows, brushing my lashes with the fingertip. The red moted eye.
And you.
Hyacinth,
I pleaded with him, pulling away, glancing around the austere tower room.
Look at this place. You're the least suited person in the world to end here. Without friends, laughter, music, you'll go mad.
He looked around, shrugging. I'll teach the Master of the Straits to play the timbals and the waves to dance.
What would you have me say, Fedra? If you could survive crossing the Carmeline Mountains in the dead of winter, I can survive one lonely island.
800 years.
Mayhap. Hyacinth rested his chin on his hands. The Prince of Travellers chained to a rock. It's funny, isn't it?
I stared at him until he shrugged again. The rest of the Lost Book of Raziel is out there somewhere. I've always been good at finding things. Who knows? Maybe there's somewhat in those drowned pages to free me. Or maybe someone good at riddles will find a way. He flashed his impossible grin. It wouldn't be the least likely thing you've done.
Don't, I begged, half laughing through tears. Hyacinth, it's not funny.
It is, a little.
He looked more soberly at me. Do me a favour, will you? I nodded. My house, the stable. It should go to my crew in Knight's Doorstep. I'll write out a deed. Give it to Emil. I left him in charge. If there's aught left of the city of Eloa when this is done, he'll know what to do.
I promise.
Good.
He swallowed. It was a little harder facing the reality of what he'd chosen. And make an offering to Blessed Eloa in my mother's name. I nodded again, my eyes blurred with tears.
Anastasia, daughter of Monarch.
She had defied the Tsingani and taught her son the Dromond.
What do you suppose she saw, eh?
The Lungo Drom and the Kumpania, or somewhat else? A reflection in a blood-pricked eye. What Hyacinth saw in mine, I knew. I could see it reflected in his, through my tears. A lonely tower on a lonely isle.
I will.
Thank you.
He stood up and walked to the window, looking out over the waves, surging golden beneath the late afternoon sun. On the far side of the room, Rouse, Druston, and Jocelyn watched us quietly. If they had not known it before, I was sure Jocelyn had told them how deep-rooted the friendship between Hyacinth and me was. Druston understood Caerdyche better than he spoke it. He knew enough for that. Longer even than de Launay, I'd known him, if only by a day. He had been my friend when I had no one else to call the same. He had been my freedom while I had been a bond-slave. He turned around to look gravely at me.
Fedra, be wary of Melisande Charizai.
I touched her diamond.
Do you speak the Dromond? I asked, fearful.
He shook his head.
No, he said with a rueful smile. Your life takes more odd turns than a mendicant's tale. I doubt I could see past tomorrow's sundown. It's easier to look backward, you know. It's all fixed, no matter how far back it reaches. I speak as one who knows you, no more. If you ever have a chance to confront her alone, don't take it.
Do you truly think I don't hate her enough to trust myself? I asked with a bitter laugh.
You weren't there in the wagon with me when I awoke after her betrayal.
I was there at the Hippocamp when I threw away my birthright to bring you out of the trance the mere sight of her sent you into, he said. Whatever caused it, it's not all hatred.
She should never have let go the leash when she set that collar on you. Don't give her the chance to lay a hand on it again.
It was fair.
More than fair, it was likely true, in the darker corners of my soul, which I did not care to acknowledge. I bit my lip and nodded.
I won't. Blessed Eloa grant I have a chance to heed your words.
Good. He looked at all of us then. If you don't mind, he said quietly, I'd like to be alone for a little while, I think. I may as well start getting used to it before we say our farewells. And you've a campaign strategy to plan once the Master of the Straits has shown you what he may. You'll need your wits about you.
Chapter 79. So it was that there were only four of us, and not five, who gathered once more atop the high temple of the Master of the Straits.
"You are ready?"
he asked, in that voice that spoke many tongues at once. Numb with grief, it no longer seemed so strange to me.
"Show us what you will, my lord," I said for us all.
The Master of the Straits swept his arm through the air above the bronze vessel, the trailing sleeve of his robe shifting to amber in the low sunlight.
"Behold," he said, "war."
The word held all the cold, benighted terror of the ocean deeps. We stood around the tripod and watched as pictures formed on the surface of the water. Scaldi, tens of thousands of them, armed with spear and sword and axe, helms on their heads, bucklers on their arms. Thousands of Scaldi pouring over Dungeline borders through the northern pass. Bands of Scaldi riding across the flatlands and ranging along the Rhenus, hurling spears at Dungeline ships sailing on the river, whirling and retreating from the answering volley of arrows. Scaldi in the lower passes, holding ground, drawing Dungeline soldiers eastward. And in the mountains of Cumlach, Isidore d'Eglamour, glittering in armour, waited in command of some 5,000 men, all answering to the flaming sword of the allies of Cumlach. I pressed my fist against my mouth, watching. They had known Selig's invasion plan. I told them as much. I had thought Isandra had believed. Was it too much to ask that an entire army obey the Queen's command on the say-so of a servant of Narmar, turned runaway Scaldi slave? And one convicted of murder, I remembered grimly. But surely Isandra was clever enough to credit the intelligence elsewhere.
"Wait," said the Master of the Straits.
The pictures on the water changed. The Scaldi horde swept down from the northern pass like locusts, killing as it came. I saw Voldemar Selig himself, massive atop his charger, commanding the left flank. Kolbjorn of the Mani, whom Selig trusted, led the right. The horde was strung out, the centre falling behind. There were so many of them, it wouldn't have mattered if the Dungelines hadn't known. I saw the apple-tree banner of Percy de Somerville flying beneath the silver swan of House Courcelle, as a vast portion of the Dungeline army withdrew from the lower passes, wheeling and turning, regrouping and surging north across Narmar to intercept the Scaldi. And in the mountains of Cumlach, I saw Isidore d'Eglamour raise his hand and shout a command. Did he know, I wondered, that Selig had betrayed him? His force, arrayed in deadly efficiency, was poised to descend. Quintilius Rouse, his voice ragged with tears, called curses down on d'Eglamour's head. And then, inexplicably, confusion broke out among d'Eglamour's ranks. The allies of Cumlach, turning, milling. I stared at the waters, trying to sort out what was happening. When I saw, I wept. The rear guard of d'Eglamour's own force had fallen upon his men, slashing and killing. And here and there among them, in the pockets where the fighting was fiercest, I saw crude banners lashed onto spear poles. The insignia of House Trevelyan, three ships and the Navigator's Star. Young men who went down fighting wildly. I could see the cry their lips shaped as they fought and slew. I'd heard it long ago, chanted as they rode in triumph.
Baudouin, Baudouin!
It had been Gaspard Trevelyan's plan to to send Baudouin's glory seekers into Camlach. Whatever part they may have played in the schemes of the Lioness of Azal, they paid their debt in full that day. They didn't fall alone, the glory seekers of Prince Baudouin de Trevelyan. There had been others among the allies of Camlach loyal to the crown. They had to have known it was suicide. Even as I watched, horror-stricken, the Duke d'Aiglemont rallied his loyal forces, shouting soundlessly. But it had been enough to shatter d'Aiglemont's attack. A handful of surviving rebels fell back and peeled away, retreating at speed down the mountains. The quickest among d'Aiglemont's men would have pursued, but the Duke held them back, gathering to assess his forces. He was too clever for haste in battle. Those rebels captured alive, d'Aiglemont interrogated. One of them, one of the glory seekers, laughed and spat at the Duke, while d'Aiglemont's men wrestled him to his knees and put a sword to his neck. D'Aiglemont asked him somewhat. Even without hearing, I could guess the answer by the terrible expression on Isidore d'Aiglemont's face. He hadn't known Voldemar Selig had betrayed him. He knew it now. He killed the messenger. Would that the Master of the Straits' charmed basin hadn't shown what happened to the fleeing rebels, but it did. We watched as they gained the fields of Namar, d'Aiglemont's force following in leisurely pursuit. Bent on escaping the allies of Camlach, they ran straight into the forces of Voldemar Selig. Jocelyn made a strangled sound. I turned away.
"Watch,"
said the Master of the Straits, his voice remorseless. It was a slaughter. It was swift, at least. The Skaldi are trained to kill efficiently, and Selig's warriors especially. I watched them sing as they killed, blades reddened. Doubtless I'd heard the songs before. In the vague distance I could make out the shining hawk banners of d'Aiglemont's advance guard, beating a prudent retreat, unseen by the Skaldi invaders. And then the bulk of the d'Angeline army swept onto the scene. The fighting was too widespread to compass. We pieced it together, watching. Percy, Comte de Somerville, rode at the head of the army, driving a wedge into the weak middle of the Skaldi masses. Ah, Ella, were the bloodshed! It was dreadful to behold. I tried to number the banners in the d'Angeline army and could not. Siovalise, Isandine, Lagnesites, Cuchuline, Namoran. No Azalees, for they were ranged along the northern border holding the Rhenus. And no Carmeline, for they were with d'Aiglemont, or dead. I saw the gold lion of the Royal House of Aragon flying above a company of foot soldiers, some thousand strong, who wore flared steel helms and fought with well-trained efficiency, using long spears to force back the Skaldi foot. I saw, to my surprise, the Duke Barquier Lambert at the head of 200 Acadian Tors cavalry, harassing the right flank of the Skaldi with short bows. Drustin Mab Nectina leaned forward, alert with interest. I couldn't blame him. The Duke grinned broadly as he rode, the ends of his burnous trailing at the base of a conical steel helm, and his riders wheeled and turned like a flock of starlings, releasing a deadly shower of arrows. One took Colbjorn of the Marni through the eye, and I wasn't sorry to see it. I'd had my doubts of Barquier Lambert, who had been my Lord de Launay's enemy for so long, but I was glad now he was on our side. In the end, the Skaldi were simply too many. The Comte de Somerville's wedge broke the Skaldi centre, driving a dreadful swath of carnage. The right flank was in disarray, breaking up in a surge to meet Lambert's fleeting attacks. But on the left, to the east, was Voldemar Selig. I watched, unable to look away, as Selig gathered his forces, roaring soundlessly, and brought them to bear on the d'Angeline army, closing in from behind on the rear guard of the Comte de Somerville's driving wedge. It was a rout. To de Somerville's credit, it was an orderly one. I never fully understood until then how he'd come to the title of Royal Commander. I understood that day. A line of Lagnesite archers, protected by the cavalry, took their positions, kneeling with long bows in hand, Faces grim, they held their position, firing volley after volley, holding the Scaldi at bay, while the Dongeline army retreated. Most of them would die, although Barkiel Lanvert's men, riding like Raus's 10,000 Arcadian devils, saved more than a few. But the Dongeline army's flight was secured. They fell back on Trois-le-Mont in the foothills of northern Namur. Later I learned de Sommerville had known it was likely. Trois-le-Mont had been made ready for their retreat, stocked and garrisoned, fortifications in place. Isandre de la Courcelle, who would stand or die with Terdange, was there. It was the first thing we'd seen in the waters of the Master of the Straits's bronze basin, and it was the last. The face of Isandre de la Courcelle, the Queen of Terdange. Drustin drew a deep breath. Then the moving images faded from the surface of the water. In their place rose a map of Terdange.
"Do you understand?" the Master of the Straits asked and pointed. "Here," he said, indicating the location of Trois-le-Mont. "The Dongeline army is besieged."
His finger moved in a small circle.
"All around the Scaldi threaten."
He traced the northern border of Azal.
"Here, too, in lesser numbers, but enough to harry. Here, and here,"
he pointed at the lower passes,
"the fighting is at a standstill. The numbers were too few, and here,"
he indicated the eastern edge of Isandre that bordered on Caerdyca Unitas,
"a force of the allied Caerdyces city-states holds, lest the Scaldi break through."
"Cowards," Quintilius Raus muttered, his voice full of loathing.
"The best they would offer, no doubt. My lord, can you tell me where my fleet lies?" "They fly the Swan?"
the Master of the Straits asked. It surprised me a little that he did not know for a surety, although the faces on the water gave no names. Raus affirmed it.
"Here." The bone-white finger moved along the course of the Rhenus. "They hold the northern border with the Azalees."
"Good lads," Raus said gruffly.
"Then the Duke de Morban let them go," I mused. "Where's de Morban, anyway? Did anyone see his banner?" Heads shook. I pored over the basin, frowning. "Where is Isidore d'Eglamour?" I asked the Master of the Straits, forgetting to be afraid of him. "He commands an army still, yes?"
"The Silver-Haired Hawk of the North."
The pointing finger hovered over an area along the upper border of Cumlach and Namur.
"Here today,"
the Master of the Straits said. His fingertip touched the surface of the water, and the map rippled and waved.
"Tomorrow near. He has trapped himself in his folly."
"Good," I said bitterly, thinking of Baudouin's glory-seekers, the hundreds of loyal Carmelines who'd died to pin him there. I touched the diamond around my throat. "Where is Melisande Charizai?" The Master of the Straits hesitated, then shook his head. The sun, setting in the west, filled his mutable eyes with blood-red fire. Gildas and Tilian waited some feet away, agitated. It was time to descend the steps and refill the bronze basin.
"Great events I see reflected," said the Master of the Straits. "Small I cannot see, unless the face is known to me." "History hinges on small events,"
Quintilius Raus said dryly. Jocelyn shifted, the sun at his back throwing the cruciform shadow of his sword hilt across the bronze waters.
"There,"
Drustin Mab Nectina breathed in Cruinia, ignoring us all. Leaning forward, he tapped the site of Trois-le-Mont with one finger, as had the Master of the Straits, marking the spot where Isandre's face had last been seen. Circular ripples spread outward, obliterating the map. When the waters stilled, it did not reform, but merely reflected sky and setting sun.
"There is where we will go."
He looked up at me, dark eyes gleaming in his blue mask. I glanced at Quintilius Rouse, the only one among us with military expertise, who looked to the Master of the Straits. The tall, robed figure turned away, pacing to the far verge of the temple.
"The Kruak of Alba spoke truly when he said I did not play you fair. I will set your fleet where you will, where the shore touches sea. No more can I do. I have no mastery over land to traverse it at will. First and second sisters I rule from the third, though I may not leave her soil. No more can I do."
"My Lord Admiral," I held my gaze on Quintilius Rouse. Rouse cleared his throat.
"To the mouth of the Rhenus, then, elder brother, and as far up her shores as your wind may drive us."
He scratched his chin and looked at the rest of us.
"We'll rendezvous with my fleet and Gilan de Somerville's forces and secure the northern border. Mayhap, combined, we can think of a way to break the siege on Trois-le-Mont."
I translated this for Drustin, who nodded curtly. Young and lovesick he might be, but not such a fool as to throw away his people's lives in a desperate charge.
"Tomorrow at dawn,"
the Master of the Straits spoke, turning round to face us, his face terrible and pale against the darkening skies.
"The seas will carry you where you wish. Be ready."
"We will be," I whispered, shivering. We were dismissed. Gildas and Tilian hurried past us to take up the bronze vessel, lifting it gently from the tripod and carrying it with exquisite care to the verge of the steps. I watched them disappear, piece by piece, as they descended one step at a time. I did not envy their job. Walking back toward the tower, I gazed up the length of it, oriel windows lit from within, blazing amber, cobalt, ruby, and sea green across the rocky terrain. The chamber at the very top of the tower was ringed all round with them. Hyacinth. Chapter 80. We set sail at dawn. Needless to say, much of the evening was spent in planning. At our request, the servants brought pen and ink and a clean-scraped parchment. There was no new paper to be had on the Three Sisters. I sketched out a map of Terre d'Ange and the battle as we knew it, with Rouse, Jocelyn, and Drustin looking over my shoulder, adding and correcting. Necessity had dictated by now that communication among us was accomplished in a polyglot babble. D'Angeline, Kerdiki, and Cruinia mingled together. I could not be everywhere to translate. I dare say anyone listening would have found it nigh incomprehensible. Nonetheless, everyone made themselves understood. Hyacinth listened with shadowed eyes. We had told him, of course, what had transpired in the Master of the Straits' bronze mirror of seawater. He heard it without comment, sorrowing at the news. It pained him to hear our plans, I could tell. After a time, when we had dined, absent-mindedly from dishes brought into the library where we worked, he bowed and took his leave. "I'll see you off in the morning," he said softly. I watched him go, and felt unexpectedly Jocelyn's gaze upon me. He smiled wryly when I took notice and shrugged, opening his hands. In the depths of a scaldic winter, we hadn't needed words. I understood. "My Lord Admiral," I said. Quintilius Rouse looked up from pondering a drawing of a Kerdiki catapult, scavenged from the library shelves. "You do not need me, I think, to plan a war."
"You trace a fair line,"
he caught himself, shaking his head, and a compassionate expression crossed his scarred face.
"No, my lady, we don't need you tonight."
Nodding my thanks, I returned to my chamber. If the maidservants had labored to find fitting sea treasures to adorn me last night, it was nothing to what I set them to now. I think, at least, that they enjoyed it. The young one giggled a great deal. Scavenging through trunks, piling high gorgeous garments, cleansed and restored with loving care, they found another deemed acceptable. Deep amber, like a low-burning flame, with gold brocade on the fitted bodice. A caul of gold mesh to hold my hair, and I swear it, tight-sealed vessels from some noblewoman's toilette, with cosmetics untainted by the sea. I leaned close to the darkened glass of the old mirror, brushing a hint of carmine on my lips. Red, echoing the mote that blossomed on my left iris, startling against the dark bister. My eyes I touched with coal. I have never used a great deal of colour. I do not need it. My attendants drew in a collective breath when I stood.
"'Tis like somewhat from an old lay,' the eldest said, hushed.
I ruefully glanced in the mirror. "'It is,' I said, thinking of Hyacinth's fate. "'Very like.' His door was unlocked. Candle in hand, he glanced up sharply when I turned the handle and opened it. I caught him readying for bed, coatless, in a white shirt and dark breeches. He took one look at me, then another, staring hard.
"'I'm not Baudouin de Trevelyan,' he said harshly. "'I've no need of a farewell gift, Phaedra.'
I closed the door behind me.
"'If it's easier on you to be cruel,' I said softly, "'I understand. I will go. But if it's not, how do you want to remember it, Hyacinth? On a battlefield outside Bryn Gorridum, or here, like this?'
For another long moment he stood staring, then gave his best sweeping bow, high spirit rising, flashing his white grin.
"'To the Queen of the Courtesans!'
In that moment I loved him.
"'And the Prince of Travellers,' I said, inclining my head.
Of what passed between us that night, I will not speak. It had no bearing on aught that happened before or after, and was of no concern to anyone save Hyacinth and myself. Seldom enough have I had the luxury of bestowing my gift, Nama's art, where I choose. I chose that night, and I do not regret. We were awake when the sky began to grey in the east.
"Go," Hyacinth said, kissing my brow, his voice unwontedly tender. "Before my heart breaks, go."
I went. From my sea-buried finery I changed into my travelling attire, Quinsel de Morban's gift, cleaned with the same care as the gown I'd worn. I laid it back in the trunk, thanking the bleary-eyed servants, and went out to rejoin my companions. On the wind-swept temple, we took our leave, the Master of the Straits standing silent as a statue, only his robes stirring. I would not relive that moment for gold or jewels. How Hyacinth endured it, I cannot say, but he had a word for each of us while our ship rocked on the water far below, and Tilian and Gildas oversaw the loading of our crew.
"'My Lord Cruach,' he said to Drustin, in the Cruinia taught him by Moraith and her sisters, "'I will be watching.'
Hyacinth grasped Drustin's hands, gold signet uppermost.
"'Blessed Eloa keep you safe.'
Drustin nodded.
"'The Culloch Gorham will sing of your sacrifice,' he said quietly.
Their eyes met. There was no need of translating. As the Cruach made his lame progress to the steps, Quintilius Rouse stepped up to embrace Hyacinth.
"'Ah, lad,' he said roughly, "'you guided us through the mists to safe landing. I'll not forget.'
He wiped his eyes.
"'I'll curse the name of the Master of the Straits no more, younger brother. If there's aught you need sail for, send the wind to whisper in my ear.'
"'Bring them safe to shore,' Hyacinth said.
"'I ask no more than that, my Lord Admiral.'
Rouse left, and Jocelyn took his place.
"'Tsingano,' he murmured, gripping Hyacinth's wrists. "'I have no words.'
Hyacinth smiled wryly. "'Funny. There's plenty I could say to you, Castelline. You've come a long way since first I saw you, baited by eglantine tumblers. You made the beginnings of a fair mendicant, even.'
"'That I owe you.'
Jocelyn's hands tightened on Hyacinth's wrists. "'And a listening courage, too, Tsingano.' He said the traditional Tsingani farewell then. He must have learned it among the Cumpanias.
I will speak your name and remember it.
And yours. Hyacinth leaned forward and spoke in a low tone, so low I could not overhear. Awaiting my leave-taking, I turned to the master of the straits, who stood watching, with eyes opaque as clouded crystal. "Why did you let us cross for a song?" I asked abruptly, the question arising from wherever unanswered mysteries dwell. "And Telesis de Mornay and others, why?" The clouded eyes met mine.
"My mother sang,"
the master of the straits said softly, his voice merging with the winds.
"Sometimes she sang to me. It is the only kindness I remember. After 800 years, I hunger for new songs."
I shivered and drew my cloak about myself. "I have no kindness to give you, my lord of the straits, nor thanks. The price of your freedom is too high." He did not answer, but only bowed. He knew, I think, the measure of that price. Then Jocelyn was gone, and it was time to say goodbye. Atop the lonely isle, Hyacinth and I looked at one another.
"You're right," he said. "From Monoui to the palace, we would have ruled the city."
That was all he said, and all there was to say. For a moment I clung to him, then he pried my fingers gently from about his neck.
"Ella will keep you, Fedra," he whispered. "Go, get out of this place."
All the long way down, step by broad step, I didn't dare look back. Tear-blinded, I made the descent, helped over the gangplank by Ella knows who. Colors and faces blurred. I heard Quintilius Rouse shouting, and the clanking of the chain as the anchor was weighed. Our ship set her prow toward the open seas, and a breath of wind came at our back. Up went the sails, snapping as they bellied full. Grey cliff walls rushed by in a blur, and we were clear, free of the isle, setting a northward course. I looked back then, when we were on the open sea. I could see them still, the columns of the temple rising atop the promontory, two small figures, one robed, still as a statue, the other smaller, black ringlets wind-tossed. A shout drew my attention. One of Justin's crewinia pointed. There in the rigging, Jocelyn clung one-handed, feet braced in the ropes. His free hand clutched his sword, torn free of its scabbard. He held it aloft, the rising sun sparkling a steel gleam from its length, a wild and dangerous tribute. High atop the cliffs, Hyacinth's figure raised one hand in farewell and held it. I laughed until I cried, or cried until I laughed, I am not sure which. Not until the isle was out of sight did Jocelyn sheathe his sword and climb down, dropping the last few yards.
"Are you all right?" he asked me, only a little breathless.
"Yes," I said, drawing in my breath in a gasp. "No. Ah, Eloa Jocelyn, what did he say to you at the end?" Leaning on the railing, he looked at the water surging past the ship as the master of the straits drove us back up the coast of Terre d'Ange.
"He said not to tell you," Jocelyn said. "He said not knowing would drive you mad."
I jerked my head, stung. "He did not," I retorted in outrage, although it sounded very like something Hyacinth might have said. Jocelyn glanced at me out of the corner of his eye.
"No," he admitted at last. "He said if I let harm befall you, he would raise the very seas to fall upon me and crush me."
That, too, sounded like Hyacinth. I gazed at the empty waters falling away behind us, smiling through my tears. "My friend," I whispered, "I will miss you." All day the eldritch wind blew, driving us northward. We rode upon its crest, surging forward, coast-hugging, heading for the northern tip of Azal. Quintilius Rouse held hard at the helm, shouting commands in d'Angeline and bastard Cruinia. We kept a lookout for the remainder of our fleet, but no other vessels were to be seen on these waters. When we reached the point where the Rhenus opened onto the sea, We saw why. They had been brought there before us, all of them. The sandy-beached mouth of the river was clogged with craft, ships and oar-boats and rafts, a vast encampment awaiting us on the southern shore of the river. They hailed us with great shouts, crowding the shore. Standing in the prow, I watched Drustin's eyes alight, rejoicing to see his people alive and hale. Half would have died in the crossing, the master of the straits had told Quintilius Rouse. In truth, it was a dubious undertaking. Who was to say it was not true? One life measured as naught against hundreds. And yet Hyacinth was my friend, and I grieved for him. We tossed lines ashore, and dozens of willing hands drew us landward. Disembarking in triumph, nearly the whole of our company reunited on solid ground, hands clasped, backs thumped, tails were exchanged. Our arrival followed theirs by mere hours, it seemed. We heard the stories, unbelievable to any save us, of how the great waves had cradled their fleet to the shores of First Sister and back, depositing them safe as mothers' babes on the silted shores of the Rhenus. There had been losses, it was true, when the master of the straits had first risen from the waves. 17 men and 4 horses. I added their lives, in my mind, to the price of his freedom. Dear bought, indeed. But most were alive. The twins had taken command in our collective absence, and made a good job of it. None spoke of it at the time, but I heard later how the army despaired, cast upon the shores of First Sister, and how it was Gronja who rallied their spirits, sparking them with her own indomitable will. Eamon had kept them organized, pasturing the horses, drying and cleaning their sea-dampened arms, setting parties to forage, finding coast-dwellers of the Eidlach Orr, who spoke Dongeline, to communicate with the Isle folk, a skill garnered from years of trading shouted news with Azali's fishermen. Indeed, he found some who had known Telesis de Mornay and given her shelter in her exile. And when the face of the waters returned, rising to tower above the bay and ordering them back to the fleet, it was the twins who convinced the army to obey. I was not there, and cannot properly give voice to what transpired, but it gave grist to the bardic mills of the Dalriada for many a generation. Quintilius Rouse lost no time in reuniting with his men. Not a one among them had been lost, and indeed the discipline he had instilled in them may be credited for the low number of losses on shipboard. Assembling his decimated crew, he asked for volunteers among them, picking the 5 best riders to depart ere the sun's dying rays fled the west. Eastward they would ride, in search of Guilain de Somerville, who had with him the army of Azal and Rouse's fleet. I stood at the admiral's side as they set off, saluting us both, carrying the banner of House Courcelle and the makeshift flag that bore the insignia of Cushiel's Dart. Phaedra's boys. How kings and queens bear it, sending innocent folk to die in their name, I do not know. I had been through terror and grief in the past 2 days. All I wanted, swaying on my feet, was to lay my head in a quiet place and sleep. But Quintilius Rouse's sailors grinned in the saddle, saluting, and rode out in a thunder, horses trampling their own long shadows as they set their heads to the east.
"They will bring ships, my lord, Cruark, when they find my fleet," Rouse said to Drustin in slow Caerdyche. "Ships such as will bear the whole of your army up the Rhenus."
His eyes gleamed at the prospect. Drustin nodded.
"Tonight we make camp," he said in Cruinia, looking to me to translate. "We celebrate the living and honour the dead. Tomorrow we ride to war."
Chapter 81. It took some time to get the whole of our camp in motion, but we set out ere the sun had risen too high. We were short of horses, and, to my surprise, Gronja sought me out and invited me to ride in her war chariot, brought at great pains and carefully salvaged from our long and deadly crossing. I made no protest, glad enough of her offer. It is the first and last time I have ridden in such a conveyance, and I will say this much. There is no luxury to the ride. My teeth fair rattled out of my head as her chariot lurched and jarred across the uneven terrain. Still, I could not but be impressed by the skill with which she guided her team, legs braced, reins wrapped round one arm, leaving the other hand free to wield spear or sword. We travelled along the shore of the Rhenus, most of us. There were only a handful of ships worth salvaging. Hard going, for their part, as the current was against us. Still their oars dipped and beat, and the wind lay at our backs. So we made progress, on foot and on horse, in chariot and ship, cutting a broad swath along the flatlands. Some few villages we passed, filled with Artali's river folk. They looked askance at us, fearful of the Cruinia, though their pride demanded they show it little. With Quintilius Rous and Jocelyn, I laboured to allay their fears, although I think it did but confuse them the worse, to hear courteous words from the lips of a night-court-trained adept in the company of woad-stained barbarians. Still they knew of the war, and that was some news. No village but had its militia, sturdy men armed with homemade weapons, keeping a keen eye on the river, lest Vascaldi attempt to bridge it. When we asked after Azal's army, they pointed us ever eastward. 2 full days' march we put in, and half another, sleeping the sleep of exhaustion in between, before Rouse's riders returned, catching us at midday of our third march. They rode hell for leather, Fedra's boys, having accepted fresh mounts, but no changes of couriers. I confess my heart lifted to see them coming, the corsel swan and my own ludicrous insignia, Kushiel's tattered dart, defiant on the breeze. I clutched at Grania's arm, and she drew up the chariot. Someone shouted for Quintilius Rous, and he made his way to the forefront, even as the riders thundered upon us, reining in their mounts, hooves spattering dirt.
"My lord Admiral!"
the first among them cried out, his voice ragged with exertion and pride. "The fleet comes!" He pointed, and we saw them, rounding a bend of the Rhenus, rowing at full speed down the broad, rushing river. The royal fleet, decked out in full regalia, every mast flying the swan. Such was their speed, the riders had scarce beaten them. I knew then how the Cruinia army had felt, seeing our modest ship. We cheered, all of us, and hurried to catch lines cast ashore. Over 30 ships, all told. Their masts made a forest on the river. Quintilius Rous, his face beaming joy, roared orders, relayed in a babble of Cruinia and Aaron, getting Drustan's army on board. When it was done, the ships fair groaned, riding low in the river. The oarsmen were hard put to turn us about, beating against the current. But somehow fate favoured us, a fair wind arising at our backs, filling the sails and making their task easier. The master of the Straits honoured his debt still, I thought, standing in the prow and gazing up river. Having seen to her team and made certain her chariot was stowed with proper care, Grania came to join me. We rode in the flagship with Rous. A second ship drew alongside, Eamon hailing us. Grania shouted back, laughing, blowing kisses to her twin. I smiled to see it. "We cannot honour the Dalriada enough for what you have done," I said to her. Grania gazed at Drustan, who stood listening attentively to Quintilius Rous. "You have given us a part in a story the bards will sing to our children's children," she said, laying one hand over her belly and giving her private smile. "Such is the dream of the Dalriada. Even Eamon knows in his heart." She put her arm about me then. "We heard what befell your friend. I am sorry for his loss. He had a bold spirit and a merry one."
"Thank you," I said softly, tears stinging my eyes. "Hyacinth." It was a kindness in her that I have never forgotten. There are those who are awkward in the face of sorrow, fearing to say the wrong thing. To them I say, there is no wrong in comfort, ever. A kind word, a consoling arm. These things are ever welcome. Grainne knew it. Such was her gift, a shrewd kindness, to know what was needful to the hearts of those around her. We were another day on the river, our progress slow in the overladen ships, despite the fair winds. Still there was no shortage of men to arm the oars, and no one of us grew overtired. The Sigave of the Tariff Crow put in long hours in self-imposed atonement for what had befallen us during the crossing of the straits, their hands raw and bleeding, until word of their efforts reached Drustan. He spoke to them then, and made it clear that he didn't hold them to blame for it. It was fairly done and generous. I held myself as much to blame for having failed to warn Rouse's sailors. But in truth, the master of the straits had rigged and baited the trap, and I think we'd have fallen into it no matter how it transpired. Rouse's riders had found the fleet with Guillain de Sommerville and half the Azalis forces. This was the word they had brought back to us. The other half was under the command of Marc de Trevelyan, further southeast. Between the two of them they covered a long stretch of border, and the half-destroyed remnants of four bridges that might be used to cross the Rhenus. We would sail as far as the first bridge. Beyond that, Rouse's ships could not travel. Their value lay in securing the length of the river between bridge and sea. We'd only caught their mast at the bridge because a tenacious party of some 1,500 Scaldi was rumoured to be gathering for an assault on the bridge. I do not think a river crossing ever played any part in Selig's invasion plan. Surely, from what we had seen, the bulk of the Scaldi horde had flooded through the northern pass. But if he did gain control of Azal's border, he would have unlimited access to Terre d'Ange, and a strong foothold in the flatlands. And if he did not, with a mere handful of men, and a few thousand were little more than that to Selig, he tied up the forces of an entire province, and ensured that Azal's army wouldn't fall upon his back. A leader who thinks. Gonzago de Escabares had spoken truly. When the shouting clamour of battle, steel on steel, reached our ears, I knew we must be nigh. We saw it first in the flagship. The Scaldi had found an engineer or two among their number, and in the absence of Rouse's fleet, mounted a full-scale effort to restore the bridge. They'd adopted Tiberian tactics, digging fortifications along shore and constructing narrow rolling walls to shelter the builders. Tiberian soldiers, however, wouldn't have broken ranks and disregarded order halfway through the process, forging forward under cover of a hail of spears, inching crude rafts along the half-drowned bridge supports. Only a few hundred had gained d'Angeline soil, but the rest were bidding fair to cross, keeping Guillain's men a spear cast's length at bay. He'd only 700 under his command, and I learned later that his archers had spent their arsenal over the past 2 days, hoping to hold off the Scaldi until our arrival. They'd succeeded, if only barely. The Scaldi froze as our 30-odd ships drew upriver. I dare say they'd posted a lookout for the fleet's return 2 days ago, but that discipline too had crumbled in the blood fever of launching a full attack. My heart filled with icy fear at the familiar sight of them, Scaldic warriors, iron-thewed and ferocious. It's as well that d'Angeline women don't ride into battle. Quintilius Rouse never hesitated. Each ship had a full complement of his own sailors on board, trained to obey the admiral's voice without thinking. He raised it now, roaring orders as if to shout down the ocean, incomprehensible commands that only sailors understand. The Scaldi began to chant Voldemar Selig's name. I dare say Drustan Mab Nectina grasped Rouse's plan quickly enough. Leaping onto the prow of the flagship, his misshapen limb no obstacle to his agility, he called out to the Cruinia. On each ship a line of archers formed along the shoreward side, protecting the sailors who scrambled overboard like monkeys.
catching cast lines and hauling the ships toward the shallow waters along the foreign bank. At the bridge, the Scaldi broke ranks, the greater number surging back toward the flatlands. If nothing else, they are bold. Those trapped on Dangeline's soil never looked back, but began composing their death songs. I heard the sound of it rise, fierce and hard, chilling my spine. No doubt the Azalis felt the same. Our ships grounded in the shallows. Planks were lowered with a crash, some reaching the bank, some landing in water. Drustin, red cloak whipping around him, shouted orders. Ramps were dropped into the holds, horses brought up, wild-eyed and terrified, Cruinia and Dalriada scrambling to arms. It was something to see, an entire army boiling over the fleet's edge, plunging down planks, churning water and soil into mud. I understood, for a brief moment, why poets sing of such things. And then the fighting began. It didn't last long. Fierce as the Scaldi are, they are men, and bleed and die like men. And nothing in all Voldemar Selig's planning had prepared them for Drustin's wild army. Blue world faces spilling out of ships, fighting with a ruthless ferocity that equaled their own. What he had told them of Dangeline's, I can only guess. But if the Scaldi, trapped between Guilain's men and the river, thought to find their opponents soft, they soon found otherwise. The Azalis fought with dire efficiency under his command. Any reluctance at serving under a Lagnasite lord, it seemed, resolved by the return of Marc de Trevelyan. I saw it all from shipboard, warded by Jocelyn and a loyal handful of Fedra's boys. After what had happened outside Bryn Gorridum, Quintilius Rouse wasn't minded to take any chances with my safety. When it was done, Drustin's Cruinia returned, bloodstained and victorious. They'd taken few losses, although the lords of the Dalriada were unhappy at the necessity of having to leave their war chariots aboard the ships. The ships themselves, alas, were well and firmly grounded. It took 50 men or more to push the flagship free. Rouse left Jean Marchand in charge of the rest, and the oarsmen took us across to Dangeline soil. We found the Azalis grimly attending to the aftermath of battle. It is a thing one needs see only once to make it a familiar sight, etched forever in memory. We descended together, a small party, Rouse, Jocelyn, and I, with two of Fedra's boys, Drustin, Aemon, and Grania, and a small honour guard of Cruinia and Dalriada. The blue-painted faces of the Cruinia no longer seemed strange to me, but the Azalis stared as they pointed us toward Guilain de Sommerville. Drustin understood some of the whispers, I think. He was quick to learn, and had gained some Dangeline during our journey. Nonetheless, he gave no sign of it. Aemon, who understood none of it, scowled. While he bore no woad on his face, his lime-stiffened hair marked him well enough as a barbarian. Grania, surrounded by staring Dangeline warriors, smiled and did not look in the least displeased. We came upon Guilain de Sommerville in the midst of directing the disposal of the Scaldi dead. I had heard he was a sensible man, and indeed if not for his standard-bearer standing near, I'd not have known him for a lord's son. White-framed and sturdy, he was attired in a well-worn cuirass, simple steel and oiled leather straps. He took off his helmet as we approached, running a gauntleted hand through damp golden hair.
"I didn't believe it when your men told me, Lord Admiral," he said bluntly.
His eyes were a pale blue, like his father's, and he had the broad features of a Lagnasite farmer. Quintilius Rouse bowed, as did Jocelyn. I curtsied. Drustin and his folk remained upright, owing no obeisance to Dangeline peerage.
"My Lord de Sommerville," Rouse said, "this is Drustin Mab Nectina, the Cruach of Alba, and Aemon and Grania MacConnor, lords of the Dalriada."
I translated for them, and they did bow then, or at least inclined their heads. Guillain de Somerville looked at them with something like wonder.
"You really did it,"
he said in awe, and gave a startled bow back to them. "Your Majesties."
"Not I," Rouse said gruffly. Putting a hand on my back, he shoved me forward. "Ferdinand de Launay, Isandre's emissary."
"The Queen of Terdange," Guillain said automatically. His eyes widened at me.
"You're de Launay's whore?"
I do not think he meant it ill. Thus had I met his father, returning from my sojourn to Valerian House, the day the old Cruach of Alba had met with Ganelon de la Courcelle. I remembered well how de Launay had sent Alcuin to the royal commander, Percy de Somerville, that night. It had sealed the compact between them, I think. If de Launay did not take de Somerville into his confidence, still he was nothing loath to trust his loyalty. But that was what Alcuin and I had been to Percy de Somerville, de Launay's whores. No surprise that his son knew naught else. What did surprise him was a pair of castellene daggers flashing out of their sheaths, Rouse's sailors hissing in disapproval, a curt order from the Cruach of Alba, and half a dozen Cruinia and Dalriada blades pointed at his neck. I was right. Drustin did understand a fair bit of Donjeline. Guillain de Somerville blinked.
"My lord," I said calmly, "I was born to an adept of the Night Court, trained by Cecily Lavaux Perrin of Sirius House, and completed my mark in bond service to Anarfiel de Launay de Montrev. Is my lineage in question?"